Hello, this is Jameson Lupp.
And I'm Gary Leland, and you're listening to episode 112 of the Crypto Cousins Podcast.
Feed your interest in Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies by joining Hall of Fame podcaster Gary Leland on the Crypto Cousins Podcast. And remember, we are all cousins in the world of crypto. This week's price of Bitcoin:
$9,458. That's down $341, or 3.5% over the past 7 days.
Howdy, howdy, howdy. Jameson, thanks for joining me on the show. Give you a Texas howdy there.
Great to be here.
Hey, we really don't know each other. We've never met, but we've been kind of chatting a little bit because I've been trying to get you to BitBlock Boom. And then I've been messing around with Akasa Node, so I thought, wow, I should get Jameson on the show. He'd make a great guest. Hey, could you just give everybody like a 1 or 2 minute, just a quick bio?
You bet. I've been interested in Bitcoin for a number of years and have been working full time in this space, basically doing infrastructure for security companies since about 2015. Spent 3 years working at BitGo doing enterprise multi-sig wallet infrastructure. And now I'm coming up on almost 2 years at Casa, which is similar, but we're basically offering user-friendly multi-sig wallets that are targeted for individuals. So I've been, spending my entire time in Bitcoin working on very simple issues of security and usability. I think that there's still a lot of work that remains to be done just around helping users be their own bank without having an insanely high learning curve that will turn a lot of people off to it. So I think it's really important for us to get this stuff nailed if we ever want to have mainstream adoption, if we ever want all of the more cutting edge stuff to actually be usable.
Well, I've been setting up a Casa node, and I'll be honest, it's pretty easy. I'm just kind of not smart sometimes, because every time I've had a problem, someone's told me the solution. It's been pretty easy. I should have figured it out. But so I'm really excited about my node now. Our last episode was someone helping me set up my node, as a matter of fact. So I guess kind of on a node series here. This makes two in a row. I also heard you, though, call yourself a professional cyberpunk. Could you explain that?
Professional cypherpunk. Slight difference between the two, though there's definitely a lot of overlap. It's kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing. The main reason that I put that as like my title on my website is because a lot of media over the years, whenever they refer to me as like what I am or what I do, they've called me a self-proclaimed cypherpunk. And the funny thing about being a cypherpunk is that it pretty much has to be self-proclaimed. The definition of a cypherpunk is someone who is trying to further the use of privacy protecting tools as a means to improve society. And so you have to be an advocate. You have to be public and basically talking about or building these tools to help people protect their privacy. So yes, I'm self-proclaimed, and as such, I might as well be a professional cypherpunk.
Sounds like a good theory. Good way to go. You might as well live proud to it. Wait, do you live in North Carolina?
I am a native North Carolinian, though these days I'm not too specific about my location.
I forgot. I listened to a lot of podcasts, so I was doing my research, and you moved. And didn't you just offer a reward if someone could find your house?
So without getting too much into the backstory, I got swatted a couple of years ago and basically burned down my whole life and started it over with a focus on privacy. So I do things like I pay private investigators to try to find me to basically, do penetration testing against all of the privacy stuff that I've set up. I have offered a reward for the arrest and conviction of the person who swatted me, though it's been a couple of years now. So I'm not holding out too much hope on that.
Yeah, I listen. I don't know what podcast. I listen to a lot of podcasts when I'm going to talk to someone to try to do research. And I guess that's how I knew you were from North Carolina at one time, because I think you were with Peter McCormick came and shot guns with you in North Carolina, if I'm correct.
That's right.
Yeah. So none of this is on my questions now. I'm just asking stuff I'm interested in. So I hope that's okay.
Sure.
So did you grow up with guns? I grew up with guns. We had a gun in every room of my house, two in most rooms.
It actually skipped a generation. My grandfather was a World War II veteran. He was basically a bombardier in a B-17 or a B-14, you know, one of the flying fortresses, basically. So he ended up collecting, you know, tons of war memorabilia over the years. And, you know, he had more firearms than we could even count. And even though both of my parents grew up around guns, as far as I'm aware, neither of them ever had any firearms. So it kind of skipped a generation, but, you know, my grandfather got me interested. And then as soon as I was old enough to start buying and collecting on my own, I got into it.
So, yeah, so in our house, we didn't have to leave the doors locked because if you came in our house, you could be, you know, you could die in any room if you weren't supposed to be in our house, I guess. Not that as a kid we were shooting people or anything, but I find guns a lot of fun to shoot. I really enjoy going out to the range. I enjoy guns. They're not sitting around my house everywhere, and I don't have them like my parents did, but I really enjoy guns. So I found it interesting that you did, and I found your whole episode with Peter about his first experience shooting a gun, a fascinating trip that you took him out to a gun range.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, my kind of dream house would have a shooting range on the property. I'm not there yet, but maybe someday. So what I actually do more often is I actually have a virtual reality room that I set up in my house, and that makes it a lot more convenient to do a quick, you know, quote unquote shooting session. There's a bunch of hyper realistic, you know, physics and mechanics style shooting games now in virtual reality that are pretty close to the real thing.
You know, some friends of mine, they have like 800 acres out in West Texas, and they just put in a trap, you know, low and high, you know, or skeet or whatever. And that is so much fun just to go out there with a bunch of people shooting guns. I mean, there's nothing like bringing out a bunch of people, everybody bringing their guns, just shooting. Hey, I heard you talking on Trace's podcast that altcoins really strengthened your belief in Bitcoin. You know, you were just talking about how you first, when you got into Bitcoin, maybe you were seeing what was happening with altcoins and the fact that the altcoins kept dying and not doing anything actually helped strengthen your thoughts on Bitcoin when you first were starting. It was a long time ago. I knew I was kind of reaching there.
Yeah, so it's been interesting because there are so many experiments going on, and actually I think that the, you know, the altcoin airdrops that forked directly off of Bitcoin were probably some of the most interesting experiments to see occur. And, you know, no one knew for sure what was going to happen, but I believe the fact that Bitcoin has been able to regain or basically maintain such a high level of dominance along a variety of different metrics, not just market cap. Market cap is kind of a flawed metric to look at, but the fact that so much of the talent and the resources are continuing to focus on Bitcoin, despite all of these other experiments that are going on that may, you know, promise the moon, so to say, is really strengthened my conviction around the fact that you know, Bitcoin is not going to die as a project because there's far too many people who are, I guess, ideologically motivated and otherwise motivated from this almost aerospace engineering type of mindset that, you know, we're going to continue to build on this protocol, even though it's fairly difficult to do so, and to do so in a way that is conservative enough that we can be sure that we're not going to break anything. So while it can be very frustrating for the average person to kind of look around at the space and see all of these other projects that appear to be innovating so quickly and doing so much better than Bitcoin, over the long run, it is actually kind of flipped my perspective the other way, that, you know, slow and steady is the right way to go with these type of protocols where we really are securing billions and billions of dollars worth of value.
Yeah. So I agree with you that slow and steady path with this much money is the way to go. But even if something comes out wrong, I mean, Bitcoin is not pushed out to all the nodes and everything. They have to accept it, the new code, if something comes out right.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the dynamics of the quote-unquote governance of the network are also interesting and possibly unique compared to a lot of these other projects. I think one of the reasons that this space is so contentious and, you know, people are arguing all the time is that there are a lot of aspects to these different networks that are very hard to quantify. And so you end up with people that are kind of yelling at each other or talking past each other because they're using various buzzwords like centralization or decentralization or robustness or whatever that are fairly hand wavy and hard to pin down. And so that's one of the things that over the years I've been trying to better understand and pin down. And it's why I sometimes write these 10-page articles, is to, you know, do a deep dive into, you know, exactly how does this network appear to operate. Because while the network is based upon a bunch of rules that are written by code, there's also a bunch of other unwritten rules that we're still basically trying to figure out how it works. It's you know, how does this like organic consensus actually operate in Bitcoin? Or you can get really philosophical and basically say that, you know, Bitcoin is this idea that is kind of floating out in the ether, and those of us who are building on it are trying to reach out and grasp that idea and codify it into, you know, machine understandable terms. But the actual thing of whatever Bitcoin is not really fully comprehensible. We're still trying to figure that out.
Okay, so, well, are there any good altcoins at all, in your opinion?
I'd say it comes down to, you have to figure out like what is the purpose of this tool. You know, each of these things is supposed to have some sort of utility. So what are we actually trying to do with it? There's a reason why Ethereum, for example, is the second most popular network out there, is because it has provided a level of utility, you know, for developers to build on that is much more developer friendly than Bitcoin is for doing really complex stuff. You can make lots of arguments about, well, if you really tried hard enough, then you could recreate a bunch of that functionality and basically tie it to Bitcoin. But it is a lot more complicated to do so. And there's a lot of trade-offs, and that's another one of those things that people have been yelling at each other for years now about what the trade-offs are and whether or not it's worth using one network over the other. So there certainly are networks and protocols out there that have utility, and I think that the utility of those networks is at least somewhat reflected in the market caps and you know how much speculation and trading is going on. But it's kind of weird how there's such a long tail distribution of all of these other networks. You know, there's hundreds of them out there that seem to be practically dead, but it's so difficult to kill off the networks that they continue to linger on potentially forever, even if almost nobody is using them. You basically have to have a consensus amongst everyone in the entire world that a certain project is unusable and dead in order for it to actually stop functioning.
As long as there's one person running it, it's still going to be there.
Pretty much.
Yeah. So I want to get into Casa Node in a minute, but I have one more question that I really want to make sure I understood about Bitcoin. And you may be the most knowledgeable or had more experience with it than anyone I've talked to. Could you explain to me the Bitcoin repository and then merge access on the Bitcoin repository, what those are?
Yeah, and this is one of those things I did a deep dive into on an article that I entitled "Who Controls Bitcoin Core?" And essentially, Bitcoin Core is the successor of the original SourceForge repository that was started. I forget if Satoshi actually started it or Marty Malmy started it, but in the very early days, I think it was after just a few months of development in 2009, that a few people started working on Bitcoin in the SourceForge repository. And then at some point a few years later, I think it was Gavin Andreessen basically migrated the repository from SourceForge to GitHub. And that's where it is now at GitHub/Bitcoin/Bitcoin. And that is kind of the shelling point where the vast majority of the actual Bitcoin protocol developers tend to work. So this is an implementation of the Bitcoin protocol. And last I checked, I think that there were 8 or 10 different Bitcoin implementations. But just due to the nature of shelling points, the vast majority of the activity happens in Bitcoin Core. And then once again, there's this like long tail distribution of developer activity on the other implementations. So there are some people who will look at the activity across these implementations and say, oh, it's all centralized in Bitcoin Core and they basically control the Bitcoin protocol. But that's glossing over a lot of minutia. One of the more important things, though, being the fact that the people who write the code in Bitcoin Core cannot force anyone to run their code. So there, you know, there is this voluntary free market amongst the different implementations. And to this day, Bitcoin Core seems to be the most trusted and respected. You know, having the most developers also tends to make it more likely that in an open source project, you will have fewer bugs, you'll have, you know, better quality control. Now, when you start digging into how does the actual code change process happen, it's best described as a meritocracy in that there are no gatekeepers that can prevent you from proposing code changes. Anyone who creates a GitHub account can then download the software, make some changes, and then propose those changes to the Bitcoin Core project, at which point various volunteers, I mean, the vast majority of people who work on this project are unpaid. They will review the code, you know, run tests against it, suggest changes if they think there are potential improvements, or in some cases, they will just flat out reject it and say, you know, this is a terrible idea because of X, Y, or Z. So, you know, how does a proposed code change get implemented or get merged into the actual software? Well, if the reviewers are not making any arguments, or at least logical arguments for why it should not be added, and they generally have a consensus that the code change would be beneficial, then eventually a maintainer will come along and say, okay, you know, it looks like we have consensus that this is a good change, and they will merge it in. And I believe there are 6 or 7 different maintainers at this point, the lead maintainer being Vladimir van der Laan, but there are about 6 other people who also have the ability to merge in that code. And ultimately, you know, you can go through different basically game theory type scenarios of saying, well, you know, what if this one person went rogue or this other person, you know, became adversarial and tried to get changes in that were controversial. And the end result of all of this, and people who try to say, well, you know, one person has more power than another in this project, the kind of the end result to all of it is that everyone is watching everyone else. You know, it's all right, happening in the open. It's all transparent. And so if one of those people who does have more quote unquote power to merge in code changes started abusing that power, it would be very quickly apparent. And that person would either have their power removed Or if it was like Vladimir, who is the top administrator of the project, if he went rogue and started doing things and no one was able to remove his technical capabilities to make changes to the project, then the shelling point would change. You know, people would fork the code and basically start working on it in a different repository. And that's how the abuse of power would get resolved.
Wow, sounds like it's a pretty good mechanism in there to prevent anyone from inside coming in and destroying, purposely, maliciously, or whatever, destroying what we have.
Definitely.
Yeah. So how many people are involved with totally with Bitcoin Core, or the group writing code, everything? Is it a large group of people, a small group of people? I mean, I don't need an exact number. I'm just curious.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's once again one of those things where there's a long tail distribution of actual contributors. You know, over the entire course of the project, I think there have probably been over 500 contributors. If you look at who is actually making the most day-to-day changes, there's probably only, you know, 10 or so people that are consistently making changes on a day-to-day basis. But then if you look at any given release, and there's usually several releases per year, any given release tends these days to have around 100 different contributors. But of course, with the long tail distribution, the vast majority of those contributors are usually only making a few lines of code change. And, you know, my name will show up in the occasional release as well. And it's not because I am contributing a lot of time or adding any new features. It's usually just that, like, I'll find one little issue, you know, tiny little either bug or like documentation issue that I can very easily tweak. And so I think over the course of the past 5 years or so, I've made, I'm actually looking at it now, I've made 8 changes, and the total sum of those changes were about 30 lines of code.
Oh. So, this, yeah, as you said, it's not something that's a lot of changes are happening on to begin with. Is everybody who's involved with Bitcoin Core, whatever, all volunteers? I mean, or do some of them work for companies, let's say, and part of their job description is dedicating a certain amount of time to working on the Bitcoin project?
Yeah, I think the most prolific ones tend to be employed. There are a few people who are basically funded through the MIT Digital Currency Initiative, I believe. We've then got a few people who are employed by either Blockstream or Chaincode Labs, or now you know, Square also has its own crypto team. And then there are other people who just work at various companies, and then there's a bunch of kind of like freelance and solo folks. Or people like myself who spend the vast majority of our time working on stuff for our company, but then once in a while we'll just come across some tiny little thing with Bitcoin and say, hey, you know, I can contribute a small improvement there.
Right. So you can just, you see it and you know it needs to be, something needs to be done. So you just send it in.
That it, yeah. So I don't consider myself a Bitcoin Core developer. I am technically a contributor, though a very small contributor. Like I said, I build infrastructure for Bitcoin companies. So I mean, just as a result of being on these machines, running nodes and finding various issues, either with their operation or the APIs to control them, that's usually when I come across things where I find that I can make small contributions.
When I, getting to Casa nodes now, to the Casa, when I open my Casa, sometimes it'll say there's an update. Is that sometimes an update because there's been an update by Bitcoin Core, and then sometimes just Casa has done an update on it, or what are those updates?
Yeah, so the vast majority of the time, that will just be Casa code that has changed. On your actual Casa node, there are nearly a dozen different Dockerized services that are running. And these are mostly various APIs and like the dashboard service that we run on top of Bitcoin Core and on top of LND. So those are the ones that we're making, you know, changes to almost on a weekly basis. And then once in a while, a new Bitcoin Core or LND release will come out, and we'll update those services as well.
Okay. Now we're going to get into Casa No More, because I have several questions. I have a few questions people on Twitter sent in. But before I do that, I do want to take this opportunity to tell everybody about BitBlock Boom, the real Bitcoin conference that's coming to Dallas, Texas. And I call it the real Bitcoin conference because I'm not saying it's the only, but all we talk about is Bitcoin. So it's a real Bitcoin conference. We don't talk about altcoins. We're not really into blockchain. We're really into Bitcoin. The third, BitBlock Boom, is in Dallas, Texas in August of 2020. Starting with a welcome to BitBlock Boom dinner on Thursday. Then there are a lot of events on Friday that other people are putting on that are kind of in the BitBlock Boom family. The conference is Saturday. And Sunday, it ends up with a Bitcoin brunch on Sunday. We have a ton of great speakers. And we also have a Bitcoin and guns thing that you might be interested in, James, where they go out to a shooting range. I think that's on Friday. We have a ton of great speakers. Take a look at the lineup today. And if you use the code COUSINS, COUSINS, you'll get 30% off the price of your ticket. The first two events were fantastic, and this one's going to be even better. So go to bitblockboom.com today and take a look. I've just started adding speakers, and actually tickets probably just went on sale this morning. So take a look at that. And Jameson, you know you're invited to come and invited to speak, whatever you want to do, if you can do either one. I know you take a vacation that time of the year. So maybe we'll look up.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, we'll look. Now let's get to the Casa No. Why is it named Casa? Where'd that name come from?
Yeah, it's kind of a long history. Before Casa was doing Bitcoin stuff, it was actually a distributed Airbnb type of startup that was building on top of the Blockstack platform. And I think the initial name was actually Bedkin. And as they were working on that, they realized that there were some fundamental, like, private key management issues that needed to be solved before they felt like they would be able to build secure apps on these decentralized platforms. So they pivoted at that time, and they kind of kept the sort of, you know, home theme and changed to Casa at the time. And the idea was basically that, you know, we would continue helping people with homes, but the way that we would do that would be we would help people basically improve their own personal sovereignty, you know, by helping them secure their keys and secure their data and basically secure everything that is of value that could be, you know, taken out of trusted third parties. So, you know, doing cryptocurrency stuff was just an initial foray. We certainly have much larger plans, but ultimately we want to help everyone turn their home into a castle.
Can you say what some of those plans are?
I mean, it's the Casa node ties into all of this. And so, you know, we ultimately intend to run a variety of different services on the Casa node other than just cryptocurrency stuff. So whether that is, you know, like distributed Dropbox style stuff, or, you know, potentially even your own email server, depending on if we get to the point where that seems feasible enough, you know. What we're trying to do is we're lowering the bar for essentially administering your own server. And as you've seen yourself, it's a very difficult thing to do to get, you know, non-technical people to the point where they are able to run their own machines that are reliable enough to be used on a daily basis.
Yeah, yeah, it definitely is. Like I said, most of the things weren't really that technical. It's just I'm not technical. So when you get someone like who's not technical, sometimes, like, I was trying to change the color of my node on the map, and I kept putting a hashtag in there. I couldn't figure out forever not to put the hashtag in there. And as soon as someone told me that, I was like, wow, I'm really pretty stupid, aren't I?
Well, that just means that's one more edge case that we need to add code to be able to handle.
Yeah. So it was a simple thing. I just didn't think of it. So, yeah, usually when I mess up, it's usually something pretty simple, because, like I said, I'm not really the brightest one in the pack. So let me ask you this question here. I'm going to go to a question from one of the listeners, and I don't even know what this means. When will a Casa OS image be released? This is from Secretary of Bitcoin on Twitter.
We're actually paying people out, incentivizing them to do these health checks on a regular basis to make sure their node is up and running. So I think we would get into an interesting business question around, well, do we also want to continue paying out these Satoshi rewards to people who haven't actually bought a Casa node, but they've just installed the software on their own hardware? Not a decision for me to make, because I already know it's technically possible.
Right. Okay. So let me get a second question out of the way. This is from Sovereign Hot or Not. Describe a sufficient dead man switch.
Yeah, this is actually an issue that we've been working on related to our Keymaster product. So that was really the first thing that we ever put out, was this 3 of 5 multi-sig be your own bank product. And after onboarding a bunch of users and then talking through not only their day-to-day use but their long-term use, the inheritance problem is a very difficult problem to solve, mainly because it's so personal. And so you may have seen, we recently put out this 50-page wealth security protocol document. We've actually got one of the authors of the Glacier protocol who has been working for us for about a year, and he's been working on that security protocol. He's also been working on an inheritance protocol, and that has been slow and steady progress. But once again, it's the type of thing where we've been beta testing it with some of our own employees internally and with a few clients who are willing to try it out. But essentially, the inheritance protocol is even more complicated because it's reliant upon things like what jurisdiction you're in. It's going to have to be customized based upon your own family and your heirs and how that needs to be set up. And so we're trying to build out this. It's a protocol, but it's essentially a guide that maps out all of the different possible paths for your unique inheritance situation. And so there are decisions that will have to be made around how does an inheritance like withdrawal and payout process get triggered. I think that, to kind of get back to actually answer the question of what is a good dead man switch, I don't think at this time that there is any good technical dead man switch. You can certainly build a dead man switch that, will fire if anything happens to you and you're unable to, push a button or whatever to basically signal that you're still alive. But then you get into more complicated edge cases of, well, what if you are just out of reach of the internet for a really long period of time? Or, what if you are even incarcerated or in like a medically induced coma, and in all likelihood you will be a free person eventually, but not for a long time. If you create these technical dead man switches that don't account for those possible edge cases, then they may accidentally fire even though you're still alive and you're just unable to, prevent them from firing. So basically what I'm getting at is that I think that any dead man switch is essentially going to have to operate in a similar way that current estate processes work, which is that you actually have to have sign off from various humans who are willing to put their own reputations on the line to attest to the fact that you are either dead or incapacitated to the point that it's not feasible that you will ever be able to make your own decisions again. And that's why this is such a complicated process, is because it's not a simple black and white thing. There's a lot of gray area.
Yeah, there is a lot of cases where you could just temporarily be not able to check in or push the button or whatever it is you do to prevent the dead man switch from going into place, and then it takes over. Yeah. So thanks for those questions, guys. Hey, I was at a at the last BitBlock boom we were at. We were Saifedean had a dinner, and a guy was sitting across from me. A couple of us were talking about Casa Nodes, and this gentleman was like going, "Do I make any money running a Casa Node?" And I said, "No, I don't. You don't run it for making money. I'm not making any money." And they were going, "Well, why should I waste my time buying a Casa Node and running that?" What would you say to that person?
I would actually send them to another one of my 10-page articles entitled, Securing Your Financial Sovereignty, which goes into the actual incentives for running a node. So you're correct that, running a Lightning node, even if it's got a ton of channels open and routing a decent number of transactions, the return on investment for that is going to be measured in, pennies or maybe like a dollar a month if you try really hard to set up your liquidity well. But the real incentive for running nodes on these networks is so that you are in the optimal security posture, which means that you're not trusting anybody else not to lie to you because you're verifying everything yourself. So you know that when you receive a payment, you have actually received that payment, and there's no chance that a third party is lying to you about receiving a payment.
Okay, so it's just for control, basically. Yeah. To control your own destiny. So right now with a Casa node, when you start up a Casa node, if I'm correct, you can put in, is it 1.6 Bitcoin or 0.16? Does that sound
right? Let's see. The maximum for a single channel, I believe, is 0.16 Bitcoin. So you could have up to that much in, several dozen channels. I think we limit it to several dozen just due to the processing power of the Raspberry Pi.
Is that per channel, or is that the limit on how much I can upload to my Casa node?
No, that's per channel. We don't have a hard limit of how much money you can put on there yourself, though we do recommend that you only put as much on there as you're willing to lose. It's still early days. There are potential catastrophic loss scenarios. We've had some fun times where people have had hardware failures, and then we've had to expend a lot of resources trying to help them, basically retrieve corrupted data to, reconstitute their wallet, which was not fun.
Okay. I don't know why I thought that was total on the node itself for some reason. So going back to your earlier comments about things that y'all are thinking about adding, in the future, as email and stuff like that. And with the fact that the Raspberry Pi is constantly being upgraded, does my Casa node have a limited shelf life? Maybe 2 years, and then I'm going to have to upgrade it? Or would it work for much longer than that? But if I want all the features, I would have to buy a newer version.
Yeah, so we put a terabyte hard drive on there to essentially future-proof it. I believe that would easily last for about 10 years, assuming no hardware failures. So just in terms of storage space. But the assumption that we make is that, yes, you're going to want to upgrade every few years because the hardware is continuing to get better. And so, with Casa, we're basically doing this annual subscription plan. And the idea is that, as we come out with new nodes, we will be sending them to our subscribers who are, kept up to date and renewed with their subscription. So I expect that you would be getting, upgraded hardware. I think we're going to be targeting every 2 years, though I don't think that we've officially put anything in writing yet, because that does seem to be about the cycle that we're seeing, major improvements on this tiny, mini PC platform.
Well, when the Casa node came out originally, was it originally a subscription model, or was it just, I thought it was just you bought it?
So when we initially started out, the first thing that we ever did was the Keymaster 3 of 5 multisig.
Right.
And Keymaster has always been a subscription model. Then it was 9 months after Keymaster came out that we announced the Casa node. And at the time, that was just oh, you're buying the node and that's it. But within, I think, 6 months or so, we started creating other tiers for Keymaster and basically bundling it all together and saying, okay, you know, the Casa node is now going to be at this like gold tier within the Casa ecosystem. And so at the gold tier, you get the node, you get the 2 of 3 multisig, and you get a hardware device to work with the Keymaster product. Basically, at this point, everything that we are selling is, you know, within some sort of tiered subscription model.
So when I bought mine, I bought it, and then maybe a few months later, I received a Treasure in the mail and a Casa bag in the mail. So that meant that I was on the subscription model when I bought it, and that was part of the package.
Yeah, you should have received an email as well that said, hey, as a Casa node purchaser, you can get the gold subscription for like the next year or so.
Okay, and I probably did, and I just don't remember. Okay, well, that answers my questions on that, because I was curious. Someone had when you said that, I just didn't remember it at the time that it was that way. So is there anything new coming out on the Casa node that we can look forward to?
I mean, the biggest thing that we're working on right now is getting all of the current software built and running on the Raspberry Pi 4 platform. That's just going to be this like intermediate upgrade for, you know, the next few months or so, because we're already working on the next major upgrade, which, you know, will hopefully be ready sometime next year. Continuing to look out further and further of what we're going to be able to add, you know, newer, faster hardware is a requirement in order for us to run other types of software. You know, the 3B Plus is pretty maxed out just with Bitcoin Core and LND. And we have, you know, a lot of requests in the pipeline for people who want to run things like BTC Pay Server, for example.
Right.
We want to make sure that we have hardware that is not struggling in order to run these things. It really needs to be a lot more reliable and performant if we want people to be, you know, hooking up these nodes to like their actual commerce integrations.
So what is the, or is there an advantage to, like, I have like 9 channels, I think, to my node. And some people have hundreds, it looks like. What is the advantage to someone for having hundreds of channels versus someone like me who has 9, let's say? Is there an advantage? Is it something that you, that someone like me wants to spend time getting more channels because it's somehow advantageous to me?
I think that, you know, after you've got half a dozen or so channels, you should be, you know, sufficiently diversified that you don't have a ton of routing problems. When you're getting into dozens or hundreds of channels, you know, that's getting into like enterprise tier of, you know, maybe you're running a highly connected service that is, you're receiving a ton of payments and you need to have a lot more liquidity that is distributed across many channels, or maybe you're trying to optimize for your routing fees to actually make money off of that, which is a very difficult thing to do. There have been several people who have, you know, written up reports of their own experiments along those lines. But I think for the average person, if you're just using it because you want to make the occasional payment, then, you know, half a dozen channels or so should be fine. But this is what I believe is going to be one of the most challenging things in the long term for Lightning Network is the liquidity aspect. Is we have a lot more work to be done to automatically manage the liquidity across the channels and to even manage the channels themselves. So I don't think that Lightning Network is going to be capable of being a mainstream thing as long as channels are something that the user even has to know about. So until we can get to the point where the economics of channel liquidity are so well understood that we can have software that's automatically managing all of that under the hood and opening and closing and rebalancing channels without the user even knowing it's happening. That's one of the major inflection points at which this technology will actually be able to go mainstream, is if we can get past that point.
So does that have to do with when you're setting up your Casa node, you can, I don't know if I'm stating this correctly, but it has an option for automatically maybe opening channels?
Yeah, so there is an autopilot option that is a feature. It's built into LND, and right now it's extremely naive. It's kind of a spray and pray approach. It just like finds, you know, random nodes on the network and opens channels with them. It doesn't really do much at all with regard to actually like looking at the liquidity and how it's balanced across the channels. But you know, this is something where there is ongoing research, and like I said, I believe it is a necessary improvement in order for Lightning to be usable. Really, I think that a mainstream Lightning wallet would not even really differentiate between Bitcoin on-chain or Lightning off-chain. It would basically just say Bitcoin, and you would make a deposit into your wallet, and then the wallet itself would figure out automatically, you know, how much of that money to put into Lightning channels and how to distribute it and how to essentially maintain the liquidity over time.
So you basically, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you could probably see a day where all nodes come with an autopilot and you turn them on, plug them in, and then they go out and find channels and open channels up. And then you could add some channels if you had a friend that had one and you wanted to have a direct channel for him with him for some reason. But for the most part, it would just open channels.
Definitely. This is something that I've talked to a few of the Lightning protocol developers about, is do you think that the Lightning network graph will emulate a like social connection graph? And, you know, if so, perhaps we should have that type of feature where, you know, you can basically connect to your friends. Of course, that almost requires like this other identity layer, which, of course, other projects are working on identity layers as well. You know, right now it's still so early in this experiment that it's unclear exactly how the network is going to evolve over the long run. But it does seem to be following some of the rough distributions that I actually wrote about in 2015 or so, where there does seem to be a fairly long tail distribution of the value, where, you know, there a lot of the value is going to be in a few major providers, and then there will sort of be concentric circles emanating out from that, where there are then, you know, some medium scale providers, and then even further out from that is all of the individuals who just have basically their pocket money in their Lightning wallets.
All right. On the topic of the social network of it naming your nodes, whatever, can't you do that now with the phone app, though? Doesn't it give you an option to name your node?
Yeah, so you can put a name on there. I mean, I don't really understand why you would want to do that in the first place, because I think that, you know, you should be running your node on Tor only with no identifying features. Like even the color thing is just kind of a silly little feature. I don't know how that even got in there in the first place.
I figure maybe it made it stand out on the solar system map. You know what I mean? If everybody's as blue as and yours is orange, and I thought maybe you were trying to acquire channels. So I say, hey, look at the orange one here. Who is that? You know, that's all I could figure out. Oh, my gosh. What's your favorite podcast? What podcast do you listen to?
Yeah, so I barely have time to go on podcasts. I very rarely listen to podcasts, though when I do, I really like What Bitcoin Did with Peter McCormick. I like What Grinds My Gears with Meltem Demirez and Jill Carlson. And I've also listened to a decent number of episodes of Noted, which I believe is Pierre Richard and Michael Goldstein.
Yeah, well, those are all three great podcasts. Before we get out of here, is there anything you want to add that I may not have covered?
I think that's quite a bit. I'm good.
Okay, where can people follow you at?
You can find me on Twitter. My handle is LOPP. You could also find me on my website, where I have all of my resources and interviews and articles and everything I've ever done related to Bitcoin, which is at lop.net.
Well, Jameson, I appreciate you coming on the show. This went a little longer, but I started having questions that came up that were interesting to me. So thanks very much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed today's show. A big thank you to all the cousins out there that are showing their support by donating, subscribing, and leaving great reviews on iTunes. All of those things help more than you realize. Now, you can subscribe almost anywhere podcasts are available by going to CryptoCousins.com/subscribe. Call me with your comments or questions at 747-777-9471, or you can email me at thecryptocousins@gmail.com, and I'll try to use these on future episodes. Please take a peek at the 4-Minute Crypto Show, which is produced every weekday and located at 4MinuteCrypto.com. It's the place to get your daily dose of crypto news, and as always, 4 minutes or less. And one last thing, please take a look at my new website, Crypto Crybaby. This website is for the true crypto fan and sells Bitcoin and crypto gear like t-shirts, caps, and so much more. Take a look at CryptoCrybaby.com today. Thanks again for listening. Love you guys.
Thanks for listening to the Crypto Cousins podcast. Please share the show with your friends. They can subscribe by going to CryptoCousins.com/subscribe. And if you want to know more about Gary, just go to GaryLeland.com. Make sure and join Gary and all the Crypto Cousins every week for a new episode of the Crypto Cousins podcast. The Crypto Cousins podcast and the information included in the podcast are not intended as investment advice. Investing in any cryptocurrency is risky, and you should never invest more than you can afford to lose. Always seek professional advice before investing in any cryptocurrency. Please understand, you are using any and all information from the Crypto Cousins at your own risk.